Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Astronaut Scott Kelly circled the Earth aboard the International Space Station for nearly a year gathering data about himself. 240 miles below, his identical twin brother, Mark, also an astronaut, underwent identical tests. A first-of-its-kind longitudinal study of the brothers is underway, and the first results are promising, according to scientists. MIT Technology Review space reporter Aaron Winnick wrote about the study. We'll post a link to it at WOSU.org/all sides. Aaron Winnick joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the ultimate question, how the human body holds up during long-term space travel, what do the latest results suggest at this point?
Yeah, so the first results were just published a few weeks ago now, and overall, the main message is that it looks pretty good. There were some standout results in relation to DNA and gene expression and, you know, immune system, which we can dive into a little more. But overall, the best thing about it was that there weren't any major red flags for humans spending a long time in space.
I'm kind of fascinated by this idea of change. Toward the end of your article, you referenced the idea of combating the changes. And I wondered if anybody thought about how the changes might be necessary for survival.
Yeah, this is actually a lot of the responses are definitely the human body adapting to spaceflight. So change doesn't necessarily mean bad. It's how the human body is responding. It's what the microgravity is doing, what the body thinks it needs to do to protect itself.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, absolutely. Some of it is good change for sure.
And that's good. And we know because so much of it reverted back to normal when he returned.
Yeah, exactly, which some people were hoping that, you know, maybe we'll find the fountain of youth in space by sending people up there and they'll come back changed for the positive forever. But you're right, a lot of the changes went back, especially really quickly, some of them even after days or a few weeks, which a lot of astronauts report feeling really badly when they come back to Earth, as you might expect. And so some of these changes are probably why they're having those poor feelings when they return.
Now, the length of something, when you're referring to that fountain of youth, and it's funny because when I was reading the article, well, I read several on it, and that's exactly what jumped into my mind is, oh, my gosh, you know, this is what the but no, I mean, you know, you kind of slapped me down with the admonition that you don't think we found that fountain of youth. But it does tell us something, doesn't it? Tell us about the length of, is it called a telomere?
Yeah. So one of the biggest surprises that we saw on this was the fact that his telomeres lengthen, and telomeres are basically the very ends or tips of your DNA on the ends of your chromosomes, and it's something that on Earth signals health, and as you get older, your telomeres get shorter, which they're kind of like, you know, people say like the little ends of a shoestring that are kind of like wax to protect the end of the shoestring from fraying. That's what these kind of are to your DNA. And so they thought, you know, when you undergo stress on Earth, they normally shorten, and obviously you're undergoing a lot of stress in space. But in that situation, they actually got longer, which was a huge surprise. So essentially, like, they were like, oh, no, have we found the fountain of youth in space? But then as soon as he came back, they got substantially shorter. And they've actually got shorter than they were when he left. Now they've gotten about back to where they were, but that one did take a little bit of time to kind of curve back to its normal point.
It did make me wonder, though, about using this kind of process to lengthen people's lives who are facing some kind of catastrophic illness, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of this is so early right now. This is
yeah.
The first results, and honestly, this is one data point. Which
I immediately go sci-fi on myself.
Right, I know. That's what I would love to be the case. And it's really interesting. There's a lot more research that's going to happen now, and it'll be interesting to see as other people go up that have different medical conditions and, you know, aren't specifically Scott Kelly, how they respond and if we see the same exact results, because we don't know. This could have just been a fluke with him as well.
It could have been. And, you know, Scott and Mark Kelly, they are kind of, you know, they're super rare. They're both astronauts. They're identical twins. It made me wonder if there might not be more identical twin sets who become astronauts so that they could be studied more thoroughly.
Right. And right now, there's no plans for that.
Mm-hmm.
NASA, that was like the immediate question everyone else asked, because when they're saying we need more data, you know, twins were great for this because it's such a rare thing to be able to have a genetic comparison or control set back here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over time we might see that. But right now, there's no one really in the pipeline that has the promise to provide that data right now.
There was some lost data, the data on the telomerase, which is an enzyme associated with the telomere. Why is that significant?
Yeah, so one of the things that the scientists thought might hint at why the telomeres were getting longer is taking a look at the activity of this enzyme, which can help control telomere growth or shortening. But, you know, obviously space doesn't have the best conditions, and most of these measurements were taken after they were flown back to Earth and then quickly shipped to a lab. And although most of the data was maintained, the data on that was lost during that time. So going forward, that's one of the things in future tests that is definitely going to be a focus on making sure that can be maintained, and possibly some testing be done actually on the space station itself for that to try to prevent that data from being lost in the future.
This is a longitudinal study. How long is it going to go on?
You know, right now, this was the first major paper that's been published. All of the data has been acquired at this point. So everything that's being looked at, there's no new data coming in. It's taking further looks at what's already been that existed. There are some, you know, there was actually 10 different research groups that were working on this. So now that this one major study has been published, they're all kind of putting out their own independent papers as well. So there's going to be a lot more detail coming out, but there's no more data that's going to be coming back from the brothers. They've done their job.
I thought that, well, anyways, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with Aaron Winnick, MIT Technology Review space reporter, about the twin study that was conducted by NASA involving brothers Mark and Scott Kelly. Scott Kelly went into space, but spent almost a year in the International Space Station. His brother Mark stayed back at home, and they studied what the differences were between them. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. The issue of gene activity was pretty fascinating. I mean, the activity of genes, which results in permanent alterations to our DNA, change all the time anyway, as you wrote. What happened here?
In this case, we saw, as you said, a lot of changes. So although they change all the time, we saw definitely a lot more activity. And, you know, gene expression is something that affects how DNA makes proteins in your body. So this was definitely something that we think was probably an adaptation to being in space. The body thought, I need to produce more of this, less of this. And the real interesting thing about it was, in the first half of the mission, they saw, you know, I think it was 1,500 genes change their expression. And then in the later half, six times as many change.
Yeah.
So we, right now, again, we don't know if later on, if they stayed longer, there would be an exponential increase or what exactly would happen. But as of right now, we saw that the more time that was spent in space, the more changes that we saw.
And here's another thing. The fact that the body would change at all, and that they're surmising that it's to adapt, how would the body even know how to adapt to space?
You know, it's not knowing that it's in space, but it's just adapting to the conditions that it feels. It's trying to adapt to, as so many things happen in space. You know, you don't have as much gravity pulling on your body that, you know, doesn't exercise your muscles or put pressure on your bones, which is why, you know, astronauts have to work out so heavily when they're in space. It affects your circulation. Your heart doesn't have to pump as hard because it's not focusing on trying to counteract gravity. So there's a lot of things that your body is feeling and having to respond to. So it's just responding to those conditions, but, you know, not obviously knowing that exactly where it is.
His exercise regimen in space is extreme. I mean, that's what they do to overcome other effects of space. What do they think that might have played a role in?
You know, interestingly, some of the researchers were, in looking at some of the changes, were like, well, he's actually exercising more than someone might exercise on Earth, which could prompt some of these things that might normally be seen as someone who's exceptionally healthy on Earth, or, you know, training for a marathon or something like that. So some of that extra exercise could have contributed to some of the positive changes. One of the researchers that was researching on telomeres was like, maybe that could have influenced some of this. Obviously, not all of that growth, because that's something that we don't see here on Earth. But living such a healthy lifestyle is something that, you know, it can affect us here on Earth and in space.
And it could have also affected the body bacteria. That was another piece of data that they looked at. What'd they learn there?
Yeah, exactly. So they looked at a number of things, ranging from the immune system to everything from how his eyes change shape and things like that. And exactly what, as working out more, some of those different conditions within the body changed, and it affected how he could respond to different immune systems and things like that.
The bacteria, they found that while gut bacteria, you wrote, in particular, did change drastically while he was in space, once again, it reverted quickly to normal levels upon the return to Earth. It really says a lot about gut bacteria, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, as our bodies are very, you know, resilient, and they respond pretty quickly to the conditions that they need to adapt to.
And something that you said that sort of struck me, you said, you know, let's see, you wrapped it up, your article, with the idea that scientists can use the data to work on ways to combat the changes, as you said, through drugs or other interventions, with the ultimate goal of making spaceflight safer and less mysterious. And I thought that was an interesting choice of words, less mysterious.
You know, right now, we still have so much that we don't know about space, and especially humans in it. We haven't spent a lot of time there. You know, we've had the International Space Station for a significant amount of time, but that's really close to Earth. And this is some of the first data that we really have on being able to figure out how humans are going to respond when we go further and longer to Mars and things like that. And we need so much data to be able to, as you say, unravel some of those mysteries. And this is providing us some of those real first clues to hint at what we'll need to do and what scientists will need to do to be able to create the different technologies and the medicines and things like that that work in space, which some of them might work just as they do on Earth, as we've seen how some of his body responds just the same way as on Earth. But then how we'll really need to change how we treat the human body medically and prepare us for these longer trips that we'll be taking.
Does it have any implications for us in the here and now? We often talk about how space technology, you know, changes technology on Earth as well.
You know, NASA had a few things that they talked about with this. It's still pretty early stage to, again, you know, judge anything mm-hmm. based on one person, but results could definitely have results from the study could definitely have implications with, especially looking at telomeres. If we figure out why his telomeres lengthened in space, maybe that's something that we could replicate in some form or fashion here on Earth. You know, until we figure out exactly the causes of some of these changes, it's hard to implement them, but it's the first clue that these things are possible. And if that was something that could benefit, you know, someone medically here on Earth with certain diseases or in certain at-risk conditions, then we could apply this to the people that are here on Earth.
And I can't let you go before you tell us what the shape of eyeballs have to do with anything.
You know, we want to monitor everything, and one of the things with eyesight, and the shape of your eyeball can determine how great your eyesight is, and so changes in that could influence how well you can see or perceive things, which is really important if you're doing precise work, say, as controlling a robotic arm on the space station.
So any big changes there?
No, not substantially, but his retinal nerve thickened, which was like the one thing that they did notice. No major changes in eyesight, but there were some evidence to how his eye was reshaped.
When are you expecting more? There's not any new data, as you explained, mm-hmm. but when they roll out new revelations of the data they have.
So actually, a lot of it's going on right now. It's been happening since this initial study has been released. It's kind of going to be a consistent thing over the next few months as these things get solidified. Additionally, a couple of the researchers that I talked to are bringing in additional data from other astronauts and are working on trying to bring that data in as well. So over the next few years, this is going to be a platform on which all these scientists can really build and use as a comparison point now that we have our real first control or first data that is going to spur all of these other research projects forward.
Erin Winnick, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Erin Winnick is an MIT Technology Review space reporter. She wrote about NASA's twin study when what it taught. What it's taught us about living in space. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Instagram and its parent company, Facebook, recently banned a number of extremists from their social media sites. Facebook says it's about safety and has nothing to do with ideology or political party. President Donald Trump thinks Facebook is picking on right-wing extremists and last week threatened to monitor social media sites for censorship. Washington Post tech policy reporter Tony Rahm has been covering the issue. He joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How does Facebook justify the bans?
Yeah, Facebook has been under a lot of pressure for quite some time now to take action against content that some users and even some regulators find objectionable on its platform. And the kinds of content that it's under pressure to take down is pretty wide-ranging. It's everything from hate speech like white supremacy to the spread of violent videos like what we saw after the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand. But in this case, Facebook found that a number of individuals, many associated with the far-right political movement, violated its policies and essentially had posted content deemed, quote, dangerous in the estimation of Facebook. And so the people that were targeted included Milo Yiannopoulos, Laura Loomer, two far-right individuals who comment on politics online, and Alex Jones, the founder of InfoWars, which is a well-known conspiracy theory site that at times has attacked even the victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in 2012. Now, as you pointed out, Facebook did take some criticism for the decision because some of the individuals it banned were folks who write for organizations like Breitbart, a right-leaning news organization. And that's what ultimately invoked President Trump's ire just a few days ago.
He threatened last week to monitor social media sites for their what he called censorship of American citizens. And you made the point that censorship is a government role. Non-government entities aren't covered by it.
Yeah, the president is sort of conflating two different things.
Yeah.
The first is that he said that what Facebook and its peers in social media have done is a violation of the First Amendment. That certainly is not the case here because the First Amendment pertains to the government's regulation of speech. There's nothing under law that stops a company like Facebook for setting the policies for what users can and can't do on the site and then enforcing those policies like it did just a few days ago, even if other users find those decisions to be objectionable. But the second thing here is that President Trump and his allies for some time now have alleged that social media sites are biased against conservatives. They haven't really pointed to a great deal of evidence of this, and the companies themselves have long denied those charges. But Trump repeatedly has threatened regulation and other forms of oversight because of what he thinks is a form of censorship targeting folks on the right.
Does he have a legal leg to stand on? I mean, the government, he's suggesting doing exactly what the First Amendment says he cannot do.
Well, in some cases, it would ultimately depend. The president has never actually specified what this would look like. His allies have never really specified what this would look like. In many cases, he's talking about oversight and, you know, he's convened companies and he's pressed individual tech executives on this issue of censorship. But there's no proposal out there on the part of the White House that really explains what it's contemplating with respect to social media regulation. But there are some things that lawmakers and the White House could potentially do here. And it really has to do with this longstanding protection that a lot of social media sites have under law from lawsuits, from being held liable for the content posted by their users. It's this perhaps little known portion of federal law called Section 230 that essentially tech companies argue has allowed them to accept user comment, to accept videos and other sorts of content without fear of the site being sued. And so often when you hear these criticisms of conservative bias, lawmakers will follow up by saying perhaps they should no longer immunize companies from those lawsuits that would be brought by individuals who feel they've been wronged.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the decision by Facebook and Instagram to ban certain extremist groups. My guest is Tony Rahm. He's a tech policy reporter for The Washington Post. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 615-492-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A Facebook spokesperson in an email that I read about called the evaluation process extensive. What do we know about how Facebook does this anyways?
Yeah, we know a bit about Facebook's policies here. Like most social media platforms, Facebook has a pretty exhaustive list of what it does and doesn't allow. And in many cases, Facebook prohibits folks from attacking people on the basis of race, religion, ethnicity, or other forms of protesting characteristics. And it generally prevents folks from spreading disinformation around very sensitive issues. For instance, around Election Day, users aren't allowed to deceive other users about how to vote or when to vote. That's something that Facebook would actively take down. And then Facebook operationalizes those policies really in two primary ways. The first is it has powerful artificial intelligence tools that can stop some of this content from being seen by, you know, folks like us who use a site like Facebook. Those artificial intelligence tools can take down fake accounts, or they can spot images or texts that have words or phrases that might be associated with hateful ideologies, for example. And then it also has human reviewers who take a look at this content when it's been flagged to the company, and then, you know, allow that content to continue to stay up on the site, or ultimately it has to be taken down. And other sites have similar systems in place. Twitter, YouTube, for example, they also rely heavily on a mix of technology and human reviewers to do that work. And in some cases, these companies say that they've had some success. They're now taking down more fake accounts and taking down more instances of hate speech than they have in the past. That's largely a function of the attention that the issue is getting, because lawmakers around the world are pointing out that these companies just need to do better. But on the other hand, even they acknowledge that there's still much more work to be done, that harmful content does tend to spread and go viral in real time. And that's something that we actually saw just a few weeks ago as we were watching the impacts of the shooting in Christchurch, New Zealand. There was a video that had been uploaded to Facebook and to other social media sites. The company tried to take down some of that graphic, violent footage, but users who had, you know, more mischievous, malicious intents in mind found ways to evade those censors. So it's still an evolving process on the part of Facebook and other companies.
Chris, in Columbus, you're on the air with Washington Post tech policy reporter Tony Rahm. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was just going to ask what you guys thought about the just overt hypocriticalness of the conservatives and Trump, where they say they want to crack down on Twitter and Facebook for this, even though they're a private company. But yet a Christian baker who has a private business doesn't have to bake a cake for a gay wedding when that's clear discrimination.
Tony Rahm, are we on parallel issues here, or is there a point?
Well, I can't speak too much to the comparison that Chris drew there, but I can say that one of the issues that Republicans have raised for some time now is that they just think that their perspectives are silenced on social media and that they don't reach as many people as folks on the left do. And empirically, we can say that that's just not the case. I mean, the president has nearly 60 million Twitter followers, I believe, as of last count. He managed to use Facebook to reach a drove of voters ahead of the 2016 election. So it's certainly the case that prominent conservatives are getting their messages out there. And I think folks on the left actually sometimes would say that they're the ones that are being targeted. They think that they're not getting a fair shake at the end of the day with the policies that social media companies have in place. So it's something that we do hear on both sides of the aisle, though it's proportionately coming from the conservative side. And the reason that they do this is because they see these channels as important to reaching voters, as important to getting their political message across, and they fear they're not going to be able to continue to do so, even though there's no evidence of that.
Chris, thanks a lot for your call. Anybody else have a question or comment? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Social media companies have been vague when discussing why they choose to ban someone. They don't explicitly explain each case. Why is that? What's the strategy that we know about?
Yeah, you raise a really important point, which is the transparency or the lack thereof around some of these decisions. It really is a black box when you're using a site like Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. It's hard sometimes to know why you're seeing the posts and the videos and the other content that you're seeing. And at the same time, it's also hard to know when Facebook, Google, or Twitter are taking down things and why they're taking them down. I mean, often, you know, outside of the individual whose content has been flagged by a company like Facebook, it's not clear to us exactly what's been targeted, has taken action against Alex Jones of InfoWars in the past without specifically pointing to individual pieces of content that they say is a violation of his policies. And so it's this lack of transparency sometimes that ends up breeding concerns that companies have political biases in one direction or the other. Because people can't exactly see everything they're doing, they're likely to come up with conclusions of their own. And so that's why you're seeing more lawmakers begin to talk about the need for companies like Facebook to be more upfront with users about the decisions they're making on the platform.
And how so? I mean, how are lawmakers responding to this? Are they just, is it all just talk, 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 or is somebody introducing anything? Yeah.
Well, it's sort of a mix of all of the above. I mean, on the conservative side, lawmakers have held a series of hearings to explore this issue of allegations of conservative bias online. And no matter how many times a company like Facebook says that they are not making decisions based on politics, this presumption still pervades even the highest echelons of the Republican Party, with the president's tweet just a few days ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey was in town just last month to have meetings with key decision makers in Washington. And he sat down with President Trump, and Trump used most of the meeting to complain about fears that his followers were being deleted from the site, which is something that actually is not happening. There's no evidence of this occurring. Twitter is just rooting out spam and fake accounts, but it's something that President Trump still believed and raised with the Twitter executive. Beyond those hearings, though, there hasn't been a whole lot of talk about doing anything about it. There are scattered bills out there that might require companies to be more transparent about how their algorithms work. But, you know, this is just another area in which lawmakers have failed to find compromise and really haven't done a whole lot to turn bills into law.
How does Twitter's history and policies with this issue compare to, say, Facebook and Instagram?
I think they're all on the same footing when mm-hmm. it comes to their responses to lawmakers and to the president. They all maintain that they are not politically biased, they are neutral political platforms, and they seek to serve all users. And something that Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey said to lawmakers just last year, I think, is really relevant here. He was brought up to Capitol Hill to testify about these allegations of bias. And he told lawmakers that if the company had tried to act in a way that disadvantaged conservatives, those users wouldn't come back to the platform and Twitter wouldn't be a successful business. So it's in the interest of Twitter and its peers in Silicon Valley mm-hmm. to be open to all political viewpoints. That's the only way these sites can grow into the public spaces that I think their executives want them to be. But at the same time, the executives do acknowledge that they have one political trouble, and it's that the majority of their workforce resides in San Francisco. It's the liberal-leaning Silicon Valley Bay Area, right? They largely vote for Democrats. They were very supportive of Hillary Clinton and very opposed to President Trump for a myriad reasons. And so you've heard time and again folks like Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg or Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey coming to Washington, acknowledging the fact that there is a political leaning towards the left in San Francisco, mm-hmm. but still making commitments to hire more diversity in terms of political viewpoints and to cater to users across the political spectrum.
Yeah, that's one thing. But we're talking about they're citing policies against dangerous individuals and organizations. They're not defining what that is, though, right? So someone
in some cases.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, in some cases they are. I mean, take Twitter, for example. This Twitter isn't the one that announced the decisions just a few days ago, mm-hmm. but Twitter has a very clear policy. You can't attack people on the basis of race, religion, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and so forth. Those protected characteristics are things that you cannot direct attacks at against people on the platform. Otherwise, Twitter will require you to delete the tweets to continue using the site. And Twitter takes into account an individual user's real-world actions. So if you are using the platform and you're publicly advocating for violence or attacking people on the basis of those protected characteristics, mm-hmm. Twitter won't let you back on. Okay. And, you know, the policy in some cases is very clear. Facebook, it's sort of the same way sometimes. You know, they say you can't attack people on the basis of their backgrounds. And I think there are people who wanted to see Facebook take the steps that it did last week with respect to these far-right figures and others like Louis Farrakhan, who has said things that are very anti-Semitic in the eyes of some users. They wanted to see those individuals taken down. Facebook finally made the decision and called them dangerous and removed their content. But there still was this feeling that perhaps Facebook should have pointed to more specific examples of what they said and did recently that made them make the decision now. Like, why right this moment? I think that was the piece of information that some folks lacked.
How have these people slash organizations responded to the bans?
Well, a lot of them have called it censorship. Alex Jones and Miley Yiannopoulos, for example, both sharply criticized the decision by Facebook, even though in various capacities they had been targeted by the company in the past for the things that they had posted online. It was just a few months ago that Alex Jones and InfoWars had been briefly suspended on Facebook, and that came after the two of them made attacks of journalists, sort of coming dangerously close to threatening the lives of reporters a day after a congressional hearing here in Washington. So they sharply criticized the company. They see it as a form of censorship, and they said that they're going to continue broadcasting their messages online. It's just not going to be on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, you can find it, you just can't. So what if I want to post something from InfoWars on Facebook? That's banned too, right?
Yeah, in this case, Facebook took the next step and said it was not going to allow that content on the site. It's something that we've actually rarely seen Facebook do. It's an escalation from what they've done in previous cases. But I think the thinking at Facebook, just having talked to experts, is that InfoWars has essentially served as a hub for conspiracy theories about Hillary Clinton, about Barack Obama, about the Democratic Party, about individual shootings that we've seen, deadly attacks on Sandy Hook, as I mentioned earlier. And so there is a fear that this content is a danger to not just Facebook as a website, but to the people who use Facebook every day and see it as a critical hub for information and for news.
Is anybody out there concerned about the president's threats to monitor these kinds of things? I mean, could this, is this a creeping threat that someone out there is worried about?
Every time the president makes a comment about taking aim at social media, you'll typically hear free speech experts who are a little bit worried about what that would look like. And you'll typically hear a lot of concern from the tech companies that fear that regulation could affect the way that you and I and other average users on Facebook actually use a site like Facebook. There's definitely that concern, but until there's a specific proposal beyond just the president's tweet, I don't think that there's going to be too much backlash. I think it, in some cases this just sounds like noise because we've heard it so many times in the past. Hmm.
Tony Rahm, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Tony Rahm is Washington Post tech policy reporter. He's written about the president's threats to monitor the, what he thinks of as censorship on social media after Facebook banned some far-right leaders from their platform. We'll have a link to Tony's story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up with Russell Holley, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Google opens up for a few days each May and gives the public an inside look at its inner workings at the annual Google I/O Developer Conference in Mountain View, California. Google I/O starts today. It ends on Thursday. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley is at the conference covering it. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back, and thanks for crouching down to block the noise, Russell.
Not a problem at all. I'm happy to be here.
You don't have a mountain view, I take it, right now.
I do not have a mountain view. I am on a concrete floor.
The things you'll do for us. All right.
That's right.
So you're at Google I/O. It starts today. Tell us about the conference and why Google does this every year.
Yeah. So Google puts together this conference every year. It's really kind of a festival of all of the different things that happen in the Google ecosystem. This is where the company has a big keynote that explains kind of the vision is for the next year for the company. It's a good opportunity for the company to unveil new products and services that are coming out and kind of a vision for what the company is going to do moving forward and to give developers tools to help them bring their apps and services to those experiences so that, you know, so that when people like you and I get new phones and things like that, that all of the message that Google has kind of all come together in one place.
Is there any overarching theme this year?
We haven't gotten any confirmation here, but last year the big theme for Google I/O was artificial intelligence, how Google was using artificial intelligence to power every single aspect of its organization. I think we're going to get a lot more this year in the way of privacy and security. I think AI is still a very important part of what Google is doing, but with everything that's happened with Facebook and Apple over the last year, I think Google's going to really try to position itself as a leader when it comes to security and privacy for users and their data.
So, all right, let's start with some of the things. Pixel phone, a new Pixel phone. What's going on? Pixel 3a and Pixel 3a XL.
Yep, so this has been teased for a little while now. The Google Pixel phones have been out for a little while. The Pixel 3 has been available on Verizon Wireless for quite some time. But it's a phone that competes with the Samsung line and the iPhone line, so it's a little on the expensive side. You can spend close to $1,000 on a Pixel phone if you get kind of the biggest one with the most storage. But the goal there doesn't really reach as many people as Google would like. So the Pixel 3a kind of takes the cool things about the Pixel, the camera that's very good and the display that's pretty good and the kind of the general feel that goes into Google software and makes it something that's going to be closer to the $500 range where we've got the same kind of great camera, but maybe the processor isn't quite as fast. Maybe there's not quite as much RAM. We're going to get a lot of details on that today.
The Android Q, what is it and why are people looking forward to it?
This is the next version of Android. This is something that we'll see, kind of an early version of today that people who are maybe not quite as okay with their phone, running the latest version of the software, as kind of a bleeding edge thing wouldn't consider exciting. But people like me who break their phone for fun would kind of install this early beta version to see what the next version looks like and what those features are going to be. And we've seen kind of early versions of that right now. It's likely that Google will make kind of a closer version to a finished, product available today for developers to check out and make sure that their apps are running well so that when the next version of Android is ready, there's a bunch of apps that go along with it that are kind of taking advantage of the new features already.
Take a step back. You're waiting for the keynote to start, right?
That's correct.
Who's going to be speaking?
Oh, I suspect we're going to have close to 15 people on stage.
Oh.
a keynote where Google talks about, kind of every aspect of its organization. So we'll see people from the Google Maps team. We'll see Clay Bavor from the AR and VR team. I'm sure that we will see Sundar Pichai, take the stage to talk about, kind of Google as a whole and the direction that Google as a company is going. We'll see a couple of people from the Android, team come up and talk about the next version of Android. It's kind of a spectacle. There'll be people from YouTube as well. There's going to be a ton of individuals to come and talk about kind of the aspect of Google as a company that they, kind of direct and have new things planned for. And it really is an impressive way across, 3 hours to really kind of get a feel for just how big Google is as a company, because we usually think about these individual services, but this is kind of a representation of just how big this entity is.
And I mentioned that this is a time when the public, gets a look at what Google's up to, but not just anybody can walk in off the street to this, right?
Well, it's true that not just anybody can walk in off the street, but Google is actually live streaming more of this conference than they have ever done before. The keynote itself is live streamed so that anyone can watch it from anywhere. And in fact, Google encourages these kind of viewing parties all over the world where Google developers can kind of get together and have kind of miniature versions of the celebration here wherever they are, including Japan and India and a bunch of places. So the goal there is to kind of have not just the keynote, but also a ton of the presentations afterwards for this 3-day event streamed so that developers can from home get access to a lot of the same information.
So how many people do you think are watching, tuning in, whatever you want to call it?
It is always something that we see hundreds of thousands of people tune in every year to watch.
Huh.
This is in very much the same way that an Apple keynote draws in a ton of people. This is kind of a spectacle online.
Okay, so back to what people are looking forward to. Android apps on foldables. We talked about foldables last week, I think, or the week before. What's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, when people think about foldables, the thing they think about is the Samsung Galaxy Fold right now, which is kind of unfortunate since that phone never actually got released, and it may be a little while before we actually see it. But there are actually several phones that are planning on coming out this year that have this kind of display that unfolds, and when it unfolds, the operating system kind of has to behave in a slightly different way And that whole experience requires some pretty special software. Google, instead of letting the manufacturers kind of create their own version of Android that handles it, they want to kind of guide that experience a little bit and make things a little easier.
There's the Google Stadia game, streaming service and gaming. What's that about?
Yeah, so we saw an early look at Stadia earlier this year, and a big point here is being able to play video games that usually require a very expensive computer kind of anywhere you are, including possibly even on your phone, but certainly on a television or anything like that. And part of that experience requires a lot of equipment and a lot of kind of understanding. And I think Google's going to take some time during this presentation to kind of explain that entire breakdown for us. So like we get an idea of just how much computing power is required and what it's going to look like for someone to play a game on Stadia from their living room without, you know, kind of any extra work.
They also are going to talk about new Google apps and services. For as far as apps go, how many, I mean, just kind of give you, they'll give you a sense about the universe of what's new out there?
Yeah, so I mean, a big part of this is going to be, you know, access to information like how much money developers have made in the past year and what kind of new services are available for developers to you know, kind of make their apps a little more interesting. And one of those things we've been talking about for a couple of years now is augmented reality. We got a sneak peek of this last year, but Google is actually going to make an update to Google Maps that makes it so that when you have turn-by-turn navigation, you know, where you're like walking through a city instead of, you know, going through a car, there'll actually be augmented reality kind of prompt to help you visualize what's going on so that you're not lost in the middle of a big city. The camera on your phone will actually be able to take a look at the things around you and say, you know, that street sign is the thing you need to head towards. And that can end up being something that makes a huge difference for a lot of different applications.
Yeah. It also exposes you to Google letting them know every step you're taking and where you're going.
I mean, that is certainly true, but you're giving them a lot of that same information by using turn-by-turn navigation already.
Right. What about smart displays? What are they looking for there as far as change?
A big thing that we saw with smart displays this past year was kind of everything being pushed together under a single design. We had a lot of different smart displays over the last couple of years, but they all kind of had their own take on what the interface should be like. But towards the end of the year, we saw Google kind of reach in and talk to these companies and say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you guys all did the same thing? And I think that we're going to see a greater push towards that, where the concept of a smart display that runs the Google operating system kind of has a single behavior regardless of what shape that display is. And that gives manufacturers the ability to, you know, focus on small displays that could sit on maybe bedside tables and don't focus on things like cameras or speakers or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also mean, you know, kind of larger displays, kind of like the Facebook portal that you would want to have in an office or something like that, you know, to be able to take advantage of that space as well.
And Google Home, I mean, what's new there? It just seems like it's constantly expanding now.
Google Home is definitely constantly expanding. There's always new, you know, smart accessories that you can plug into your home and do things. It doesn't always mean that you should connect smart things into your home, especially with some of the privacy things that we've seen over the last year. And I think that that's a big part of where Google is going to kind of take advantage of the ability to say, you know, we're a leader in privacy and security. And to say, you know, have a Google Home product, you can expect this layer of you know, safety and security, as opposed to dealing directly with these manufacturers. You know, so the idea there is to have Google Home not just be a thing that connects all of these things, but adds an extra layer of security and privacy.
That's the magic word, security. And Chromecast, they're looking for changes there?
I'm hoping for changes there. The Chromecast that we've had over the last couple of years has been this weird little hockey puck that gets plugged into the back of the phone.
Uh-huh.
That gets plugged into the back of the television, and it doesn't really do a whole lot. And with the release of Stadia, you know, there's an opportunity there for Google to make kind of a more capable, more powerful system that maybe includes a game controller, maybe includes a remote control. You know, there's a lot of kind of flexibility there for Google to shake things up a little bit, and I hope that we do that.
What about Chrome and the Chrome, well, and its operating system? What's new there, or what are you thinking about?
Chrome's one of those really funny things that's kind of hard to track unless you're very excited about Chrome all the time, because by definition, Chrome updates itself every 6 weeks with new features and things like that. So we don't usually get kind of a big presentation when new things come to Chrome. Google just kind of announces it, and then it's already there on your browser. So, you know, I think I don't know that we're going to see a ton new from Chrome that is specific to this announcement, but I think we'll see a lot of opportunities. opportunities for Google to talk about how much faster it's gotten, and hopefully that it's using fewer resources on your computer, because as some people who use Chrome know, it can kind of bog your system down a little bit.
Yeah, I use it a lot. And wearable?
I hope that we see something very exciting in wearables, but I have yet to see anything that actually confirms that. You know, the big winner when it comes to a computer on your wrist right now is Apple. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is stuff that is not, the competition isn't really just all that exciting, and that's something that Google's kind of had to compete with for a little while. I think we're more likely to see stuff happen in the car than we are on the wrist with Android Auto. A new design to Android Auto and some new features to make it a little more usable in a bunch of different designs so that it fits in as many cars as possible. But I would be cool to see something happen for wearables as well.
You wanted to talk about Facebook and how Facebook promised new privacy measures but are falling short of that. What privacy measures are we talking about?
So Mark Zuckerberg climbed on stage, and I say climbed. He didn't. He just walked. But he got on stage during Facebook's big presentation keynote last week, and he started off by saying, together we're going to build the most privacy focused social network that's ever existed. And the audience was kind of silent. Like nobody really got excited about this because nobody believed it. Like it didn't sound like a thing that Facebook would actually commit to and mean. And even he admitted that on stage. There's a good chance that some of you don't take me seriously right now. And that's really kind of a damaging thing to think about. Even the people at Facebook know that they've kind of lost the trust of their audience when it comes to claiming things for security and privacy. And the features that got announced were I think a lot more confusing than they were assuring. One of the big things was involving chat, where something called end-to-end encryption was enabled. That means that when you are sending a message to someone through Facebook Messenger, that message, it's a lot more difficult for that message to be intercepted by a third party through network monitoring or something like that. But that message got kind of diluted by saying that it was also being merged with Facebook's other chat systems that it has bought over the last couple of years, like WhatsApp, to kind of make this one massive chat system. And that's a really kind of confusing thing, because WhatsApp is very much its own thing that is popular in different parts of the world for very different reasons and has very different features. So it's really unclear what's happening next with this system.
Apple has taken issue with home repair and indie repair shops. In other words, anything but the Apple Store and the geniuses that work there. When it comes to getting your phone fixed, what do they expect people to do?
Apple very much wants Apple to be the company that does all of the repairs. And I think that Apple as a company is going to find itself very quickly in trouble when it comes to things like right to repair laws, where you bought a product, it should be yours to do with whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that's something that Apple is actively kind of pushing against with this message that if you want something repaired and you want, even when your warranty has expired, that Apple should be the only company that does that. And that's a difficult pill to swallow. I think that people who break their screen after having a phone for 3 years and know that they can still keep their phone if they pay, this guy in the mall $40 to have the display replaced, but then Apple won't even guarantee that the software will continue to work is complicated.
Well, they won't look at it again if you do that.
Right.
Are the indie repair people getting better at it? Is this getting to be real competition for Apple?
This is absolutely real competition for Apple. There are stores in the mall near me where they can replace an iPhone screen in 15, 20 minutes, and this is using official hardware, displays that are being bought from, the same manufacturers that are providing the equipment to Apple. It's one of these things where Apple noticed, especially when it started doing its battery replacements for cheap, that it had to make them cheap because they're the kind of mom and pop shops were already doing them, for $40 and $50. And so charging $110 is just a lot to ask.
Russell Holley, thank you for the sacrifice of hiding in a corner at IO19 so you can talk to Adam Fisher, WOSU. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
It's Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central, and that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.